Hello and welcome to Pedagodzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the pop culture core. Today we are answering the bloody stupid question, why is the Kobayashi Maru a no-win for Starfleet assessment? Answering that question today, we have several of us. We have me, I'm Mike, as ever, your host, Imposter Syndrome Incarnate and Senior Learning Designer at the Open University. And I am joined, as ever, by my capable co-host.
I'm Mark Childs. I'm Senior Learning Designer at Durham University. And my claim to fame here is a PhD in education. I'm also wearing a Deep Space Nine baseball cap, Maria, just to liven the proceedings up.
And by the way, folks, be aware that we do suffer from lag at Mark's end usually, so there will be definitely some overlap. Don't worry about it. And we are joined by two preeminent assessment and Star Trek experts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Crossman. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Mathematical Sciences in Durham, where I look at a lot of stuff, including inclusive assessment. I am also a pop culture critic, and I write the blog Infinite Diversity, Finite Combinations on Star Trek.
A link to which will be in the show notes.
Yeah, so I'm Mark Williams, and I'm Senior Learning Designer at the Open University, heading up some work around assessment for our learning design team. I'm not a Star Trek absolute enthusiast or expert, but I'm really kind of interested in this particular way of framing assessment, and that's why I'm here.
And just to clarify, this is the one without the lightsabers. Anyway, let's break down our question then in the very first part of the show.
Part one, the question.
Okay, so our question is, why is the Kobayashi Maru a no-win for Starfleet assessment? There are two major components. Well, actually, there's three major components to that question. One is assessment, one is Starfleet, and the other is the Kobayashi Maru. So should we start maybe with what Starfleet and the Kobayashi Maru is? Who wants to start and pick that up?
Rick, do you want to tell everyone about Starfleet?
Sure. So this is, I'll try not to get into the weeds too quickly. There are multiple iterations of Starfleet, depending which era of the TV show and the attendant films we're talking about. In the context of the Kobayashi Maru, which is first introduced in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Starfleet can be thought of as a exploration. It's a fleet dedicated to both exploration and defense, which gives it a kind of unusual flavor, because on the one hand, it's about the expansion of human knowledge, and not just human knowledge, Starfleet being the quasi-military arm of what is called the United Federation of Planets, which is a group of human and non-human races working together. So it's partially about the exploration of the galaxy and the acquisition of scientific knowledge for the Federation, but also it is the Federation's military wing, its defense against external threats, such as the Battle Fond Klingon Empire, who actually have a minor role to play in this as part of the Kobayashi Maru test. So, too long, don't read. Starfleet is simultaneously a force for the expansion of scientific knowledge, but also a defense force for the United Federation of Planets.
Space NATO.
Yes, a combination of Space NATO, Space Navy, and space field trips.
Yeah, it does rather feel like just one big university outing a lot of the time, doesn't it, Star Trek episodes?
Yeah, it's a university with access to torpedoes, which turns out to have its attendant problems, if you can imagine that.
I mean, my mind instantly goes to how much easier my life would be if I had access to torpedoes.
Yeah, there's the UFP, the United Federation of Planets, was kind of inspired by the League of Nations. When they were looking at how many different races are there in the UFP, they were looking at like, oh, let's have a similar number to the League of Nations. So when you're saying it's NATO-like, I think that was pretty much something like that was inspiration, at least more like the UN or a combination of the two, really. Yeah. So, yeah, that's very...
I mean, right down to each starship in Starfleet is USS, which refers to United Spaceship.
So what is the Kobayashi Maru? So I think a lot of listeners will have heard of Star Trek before. I think a lot of them will probably be sort of vaguely familiar with Starfleet. Not as many of them will be familiar with the Kobayashi Maru, which, I'll be honest with you, sounds like a delicious type of ramen dish.
Well, thank you for making me hungry. So in order to join Starfleet, you have to go through Starfleet Academy. And like any other academy, there are a number of assessments one has to go through. The Kobayashi Maru is one such assessment. The idea behind the Kobayashi Maru is it is designed to teach Starfleet cadets that there is such a thing as a no-win scenario, a situation where you go in and there is just no way out. It's intended as a test of character. Sometimes you do everything right and you still end up in this case, dead. So it's to, I think the intention is to train people out of thinking you're always going to win. The specific situation is the cadet takes the role as the starship captain. The starship receives an emergency signal, an SOS, from the eponymous Kobayashi Maru. That signal is coming from a place called the Neutral Zone. So again, for newcomers to Trek, the United Federation of Planets is engaged in a very long-standing Cold War with another civilization called the Klingon Empire. In between the Federation and the Klingon Empire is what's called the Neutral Zone, an area which, by mutual agreement, neither side's military forces can enter. So by entering the Neutral Zone, even to try and rescue the Kobayashi Maru, the cadet is breaking the treaty between the Federation and the Klingons. So as soon as they cross the line, the simulation is set up to have a number of Klingon battlecruisers show up, refuse to respond to any hail saying, "We're on a mission of mercy, please don't kill us," and then kill them.
So just out of interest, in the context of the lore, if I remember, was it the movies or something? Did one of the Kirks or a Picard like beat the Kobayashi Maru? I'm trying to think of, like, it feels like something I vaguely remember from one of the many overlapping kind of Star Trek things.
So this is mentioned a couple of times. So Kobayashi Maru itself, as I say, is introduced in the second film. Later in the second film, you learn that Kirk is the only person to ever have beaten the Kobayashi Maru test. He tried it twice, got the expected result both times, and then reprogrammed it so that it was possible to win. So this is presented in that film as, oh, Kirk, he just doesn't believe in an Owen scenario, he'll always find a way to win. But in the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek, which is set a few years previously, as Kirk is actually a cadet, he's actually pulled up for doing this, for reprogramming the SS by Spock, who says the whole point is it's supposed to be a no-win scenario. If you reprogram it so it is an A-win scenario, it is no longer the test. Not only have you cheated, you've completely failed to learn the lesson we were trying to teach you.
Well, that's very reminiscent of current debates around the use of AI in assessment. And I guess that possibly transitions us really neatly then towards assessment. So when we're talking about assessment, we're talking about assessment in the context of education. And I suppose to a degree, we often sort of talk about it from a higher education perspective. But let's start maybe talking about assessment more broadly, and we'll narrow in a little bit towards the bits that we're focusing on for our questions. So Rick, Mark and Mark, who wants to give us a quick potted definition of what we actually mean by assessment? Because it's quite a broad term.
Well, shall I give the learning design rationale for it, which is there are certain things you want a graduate to have accomplished by the time they finish their program of study. So they may be going out into the world and needing to enact certain skills. They need to make some positive change in the world. You define what those are as a set of learning objects, which you then scatter throughout the program. And then at certain stages, you assess whether or not they've attained those particular learning objectives. That's kind of what assessment is from a pedagogical point of view. However, there aren't enough jobs to go around, which means that you have to grade people so that you can basically ration out the good jobs to the ones that do really well in your assessments, and therefore the ones that don't do quite so well have to do the crappier jobs until you end up with the ones who fail or don't even take the degree in the first place, who end up with the lowest paid jobs. That's actually the economic capitalist reason why we have assessment, is not just to attain whether or not somebody knows how to do the job, but to grade people on a curve so that only certain people are in a position to get the best ones, and the people who don't do so well aren't in a position to do that. So that's the kind of double-edged thing that we're stuck with when we're assessing people in education, is there's the pedagogical rationale, but there's also the economic capitalist neoliberal rationale.
Yeah, Rick, Mark Williams, any advances on that?
I suppose, and coming in from my point of view, if we wanted to start really kind of being critical of assessment, and there's a lot of thought nowadays that talks about the hierarchy of assessment. So assessment structures are usually discussed by a range of different authors. It could be from awarding bodies as well, but students are never present at that time. So the language around assessment is always going to be exclusive in that way. So if you don't decode assessment and you don't start to kind of have conversations around why we assess and in what different ways we're doing that and why it's valid, then you're going to exclude students from that whole process. So what sometimes happens in assessment, probably quite often happens in assessment, is that students engage in it, not always knowing why they're engaging in it, not always being able to access it. And for that reason, they might feel left out of the process. They might not do their best. So I kind of think there's this whole kind of range that assessment is kind of testing out students without them actually understanding why. So there's a trick to assessment, and maybe it only captures those students who kind of think and feel in certain ways, and kind of necessarily then excludes other students. I think we have to kind of think about how we get past that, because I don't like to think of assessment as a game. And in this way, you know, when we're looking at this Star Trek kind of form of assessment, there is this kind of gameplay, which is very interesting, but quite exclusive as well. So yeah, quite an interesting one, I think.
I mean, Rick, you mentioned earlier that you focus on inclusivity in assessment.
Yes, that's one of the strings to my bow.
I mean, it sounds like you've got sort of more of a harp on the go than a bow. But yeah, do you want to expand on that sort of particular thread at all?
Yeah, so I mean, ultimately, from an inclusion perspective, the trick with assessment is making sure that assessment in general is as far as possible equally accessible to everybody. That doesn't necessarily mean every single piece of assessment is equally accessible, because that's not really a plausible goal. For me, it's more holistically making sure that everybody is catered to in the aggregate, right? So there's a lot of stuff about how you can't expect a fish to climb a tree, but if you put together a series of assessments where everybody's strengths are ultimately taken into account and everybody's areas of weakness are ultimately taken into account, that's what you want. So you don't want to be in a situation where you write all of your assessment under the assumption that the people who are going to be taking those assessments are all able-bodied white men, for instance. So that's my interest in assessment fundamentally is making sure that we are not excluding certain types of people in the way that we do our assessments. Over.
That's interesting. So sort of between Mr. Williams and your angles there, it sounds like there's a couple of ways to skin the inclusivity fish. One is both in sort of equipping students with the understanding of what's being assessed and why and how, and the other is in the actual design of the assessment and making it so that, as you say, the assessment in aggregate, not necessarily individual assessments, but the assessment across the piece is, as you say, playing to the strengths of everybody. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think part of a big part of it is thinking about what you are actually trying to do. In the context of mathematics, for example, so mathematicians, so this is always where I'm going to go back to, a big part of what we are trying to do within the context of a university is train up mathematicians, some to go out into the world of work, some to stay in academia and become the next generation, to use the phrase to make them back to. But what you, in order to make sure you're training up mathematicians, right, you've got to think about what makes a good mathematician. And in particular, you have to make sure that when you think about what makes a good mathematician, you think harder than just what are the current crop of good mathematicians like, because we are still in a very male-dominated, very white-dominated, very Western-dominated field. And if we're not careful, all we do is create assessments that can check whether or not the white, male, Western, English as a first language people can do what the previous generation of white, male, Western, English as a first language people can do.
It's interesting. I mean, thinking back to our episodes on graduate outcomes and critical pedagogy as well, it's that thing of sort of looking forward 3, 6, 10, 20 years to what you want your graduates to be like or to have in their hands as they leave your university and go out into the world. And also the kind of world, without sounding unbelievably corny, the kind of world you want to make through the people that you teach.
Well, we're talking about Star Trek, right? So this is the right place to be corny about the future.
It's very optimistic. Star Trek's feeling further and further away, and Mad Max is feeling closer and closer every day.
Yeah.
Mark, any advances on that before I move us on to part two?
All the things that Rick and Mark were saying, those really collide heavily with this whole thing about grading on a curve, because, you know, you open it up to more people. What's the phrase? Is a really good one. To people who have privilege, equality looks like discrimination. So all the people that have been previously, you know, sort of privileged by previous assessment conditions then start kicking off because more people are getting a slice of the pie. And the values that they have been successful by espousing, particularly maybe the older generation who have these whole set of things they can do, they don't see necessarily this as equality, but erosion of quality, if you see what I mean, because it's like, well, more people are being allowed to use the book in tests, or more people are being able to have longer to do their tests or whatever, which is therefore being a bit more slack rather than opening it up to more people. And so there we have that tension between those two views of what opening up assessment is.
So what I heard Mark talking about was this idea that if you've got privilege, trying to level the playing field feels like discrimination against you. And it's very easy to respond to that by saying you're eroding standards. So what we're talking about is making things more fair in a, from a holistic perspective, but then that is then confused. And I think quite cynically a lot of the time, confused as being an erosion of standards. But what we're actually talking about is there more than one way of doing this?
Is there more than one way of doing this? Feels like a wonderful transition, perhaps, to the second part of our show where we start to answer our question. Does that sound okay? Or is there anything, anything else we want to pick up on assessment before I move on?
Just briefly, I wanted to pick up on Mark's definition of assessment from a neoliberal perspective and a capitalist perspective, which I fully agreed with. That being the framing that in our current society. But it is worth, of course, noting that in Star Trek, we're supposed to have moved beyond that, right? So that's going to be an interesting tension when talking about Kobayashi Maru. In fact, the point at which Star Trek becomes a post-capitalist society, or when Star Trek imagines us becoming post-capitalist, is kind of not clear. It certainly happened by the time of The Next Generation, which is set about 80 years after the original series. But at the point in time where Kobayashi Maru is introduced in Star Trek 2, it's not clear that it is a post-capitalist society. However, whichever way you slice that, the Kobayashi Maru is ultimately a test for people who are entering this quasi-military organization, and therefore the assessment is not really aimed at figuring out who's going to be the best at doing jobs. It's more about who has the requisite skills to take a command position within a military, which is something that I personally won't necessarily be able to speak to with quite the same level of confidence as I with a university.
Okay, so with that, I'll move on now to the second part of the show where we answer our question, why is the Kobayashi Maru a no-win for Starfleet assessment?
Part 2. The answer.
Okay, why is the Kobayashi Maru a no-win for Starfleet assessment? Rick, you are the person, the progenitor of the question. Do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I hate the Kobayashi Maru test. I think it's absolutely useless. So to go back to what the purpose of Kobayashi Maru test is, it's supposed to teach cadets that there is such a thing as a no-win scenario. And I would ask, how is the Kobayashi Maru doing that? It's never entirely clear what the cadets are told, but the implication is very strong that they don't know going in that no matter what they do, there's no way they will get out of it. So they just have one really, really upsetting experience where they think they're being trained on how to run a starship. What actually happens is they're put in a situation where they've got no chance of succeeding in what they think the test is about. And then they're told, you've learned an important lesson that sometimes you just can't possibly win. So it isn't at all clear to me. Firstly, the learning objectives are clear, right? But it isn't explained to the students ahead of time, which is already terrible. There's no transparency. It's off a single run of this being told, you never could have won. The immediate question is, why did you put me through this? And do we actually believe that the students are taking home the lesson, sometimes I just won't be able to win? First of all, I don't see how it's achieving its learning objective. Secondly, I'm not sure that the learning objective is particularly useful in the first place. Maybe there is theoretically such a thing as a no-win scenario, but any situation you're in, you have to treat it as though there is some way to save yourself.
Yeah, I suppose a learning outcome of death comes to us all eventually feels somewhat fatalistic, particularly for the captain of a starship.
Because it is simultaneously blindingly obvious and completely unhelpful.
Mark, from Mr. Williams, from your perspective, so purposeful failure in assessment, what's your position on that?
I guess that in some kind of way that you would want your captains, whatever, to remain calm in that particular scenario. I mean, do they know going into this, right, that it's all like just a big play acting moment? Do they know that people are going to be like throwing themselves around and there's going to be all this pyrotechnic stuff going on? Do they think that they're in a real life situation here and people are literally being put under jeopardy or threat?
That's a really good question. They do know that it is a simulation in the sense that they know that they're not actually on a starship, right? So then it's not that level of deception. They don't know what's going to happen, but they do know it's simulation.
Okay.
So they're actually on the Enterprise. When we see Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, they're actually on the Enterprise. Spock is the captain of the Enterprise at this stage, but the Enterprise is just being used as a training vessel because it's been decommissioned as a sort of military exploration vessel, which becomes a plot point later on because they take the Enterprise off because it's the only one around because it's in Earth orbit and they need to go off to do the battling stuff. So they know they're on the Enterprise. So they must know that if all things are exploding around them and everybody on the bridge crew is dying, they must know at that point of, well, they know it's not real because they know that they're not in the neutral zone, so they're nowhere near the Klingon. The audience don't know, of course, because the audience, as far as they're concerned, is, oh my god, Uhura's dying, oh, you know, Spock's dying, which is the reason why the whole thing was created in the first place, was because the rumors got out that Spock was going to die in Wrath of Khan, and that would be major spoilers. So what they did was they create a scene where apparently Spock dies, so that then everybody goes, oh, that's what it was then. It wasn't for real. It was just this simulation. And so then they can tell the story. And then when he really does die at the end, be still shocked. So that's kind of what you see as an audience member.
I was going to say, ultimately, what I'm about to say is a parenthetical point, but this is another reason why I dislike the Kobayashi Maru test. It apparently requires like 5 senior officers to pretend to die. And you've got to figure they have, like, what's their workload like? Like, what's the workload model are they using? Chilly. This is a terrible use of their time.
Oh, they're probably all retired by that stage anyway, haven't they?
But that's the other problem, right? If they are all retired, like, would you mind coming in early tomorrow? I know you've retired, but would you mind standing in front of a desk and pretending it's exploded and killed? Like, no, I'm playing space golf.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like if you're an acting officer, though, I mean, if their workload and particularly calendars are looking anything like mine, the idea of my computer exploding and then having a lie down for half an hour sounds absolutely divine.
Is there also this, I don't know, I don't know this to be true or not, but is there a certain enjoyment that they're getting at watching somebody take this test and potentially fall over? I mean, because what you're saying is that this isn't like a journey, isn't it? An assessment journey is progress through your journey, isn't it? So you have different steps on your assessment journey. The first point, you progress, you move forward. Onto your second, you use the lessons you've learned, you progress, you move forward. But this one, especially if it comes at the end of an assessment journey, is all about, so there you go, you're not moving forward. This is where you fall over. Things don't necessarily work out for you. There's a chance that things just, you know, don't happen. You don't move forward, you don't progress. And is there just this sense of warped enjoyment that these people are getting from watching these, you know, cadets move into this scenario?
Kind of a Starfleet hazer.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I've been reading Mark A. Pierre White's autobiography, which is really, really good.
Oh.
Fine dining kitchens are rife with hazing, but the really interesting thing that came out of it, and I suppose the thing that's reminding me of this, is that he talked about essentially creating an absolutely hellish high pressure environment in his kitchens, particularly for new chefs, which involves basically bullying the shit out of them, which sounds absolutely dreadful, but he describes it as a sort of a part of their learning experience, essentially, in that the survivors all go on to do really, really well because they've had the worst possible pressure that they could ever experience under his absolutely dreadful tutelage. And then, you know, they all kind of credit their time in his kitchen as what helped make and break them. So I think, for example, he talks about like Gordon Ramsay's last day. He's basically just sitting by the walk-in fridge having a cry because it's all just too much. He's been shouted at too much. He's not been fed for days. It's dreadful. And, you know, he had Heston Blumenthal through his gates and everything. And he talks basically about kind of like, sounds kind of like a human meat grinder of going through people in this insane pressure cooker. But I suppose from that perspective, is there value in it as an assessment? Possibly less an assessment, more, I guess, of an activity of sort of simulated horrendous pressure. I'm so with you, Rick, in that the actual kind of like what's the fundamental learning outcome that's being tested here is so flawed. But I suppose in an environment where you might have either plates flying at you as your head chef slings them or Klingons lobbing torpedoes at you, is there value in somebody having already wet their pants once?
But the answer to that is almost certainly yes. But I'm not objecting to the idea of simulated combat or difficult high pressure assessments. I mean, we have high pressure assessments across the board for very different definitions of high pressure. So it's not the idea that every assessment should be comfortable or easy or relaxing. It's very specifically the idea that you are teaching students by giving them an assessment which on top of everything else is impossible. What specifically is that doing?
I was going to say about the Marco Pierre White thing that the only reason why you need to weed out the people that can't handle the meat grinder is because when they end up in the actual fine dining kitchens, they're run like meat grinders, so you need to be forewarned. But that's kind of just replicating that environment. It doesn't have to be like that, and it's only like that because the people that survive that particular form of assessment end up being successful, and so therefore recreating the environment they're in. I suppose with the Klingons, you have no control over them. You can't suddenly stop them from being a martial race. So I suppose there it's a bit more understandable. commendable. But, I mean, 80 years on, it's moved on a little bit in that when Nog's going through something very similar in Deep Space Nine, he wants to enter Starfleet, and he's all set up with this test, which is going to be his flight maneuverability and his ability to pilot a runabout in combat. And then the actual combat situation is somewhere where he's not completely expecting it to be, and it's on the space station itself, and they're being attacked by Cardassians, I think. And so, therefore, he doesn't know it's a drill, because the drill he's prepared for, the simulation he's prepared for, is a combat situation in a runabout, and the actual combat situation he doesn't realise is not real. So they're testing him under that sort of circumstance, and it isn't no win, he definitely does sort of respond, and he doesn't necessarily see people blowing up around him. But going back to your hazing thing, they are definitely enjoying it. The people around him, you know, O'Brien and all that, are saying, oh, well, you've been through it and all this now. So there is all these different kind of dynamics coming in.
So the example of Nog that you raise is an interesting one, because as you say, he's in a situation where he expects to get one form of assessment or one scenario, and he's given a different one instead, and he says, oh, well, this isn't what I practiced. And Miles O'Brien, who's running the test, said, well, it wouldn't really be a stress simulator if it was the stuff you've practiced. That seems reasonable, right? You can understand why they've sort of pulled the rug out from under him for a very specific purpose that they are then able to explain to it. Whereas my thing with the Kobayashi Maru is, what happens if you remove it from the curriculum? If the students are never given a scenario which it is impossible for them to win. So either you tweak it a little bit so that there is some potential possible way of doing it, or you just remove it and have whatever other simulations they have. What are we losing? As far as I can see, the only possible problem with that is you might get a student who successfully completes every single scenario and ends up being a little overly cocky. I guess that's what they're trying to avoid.
Which is good, isn't it? I mean, I think you don't want them to be overly cocky. And I mean, Kirk in the Kelvin timeline version is annoyingly cocky. Mark and I both watched this a couple of days ago, and we were both totally irritated by him. So deflating people to some extent might be a good thing. And also, how you face death, I don't know. I see
trouble with the how you face death argument is it's still very clearly a simulation. They're not facing death, they're facing failing a test, and they know this.
Also, facing death, whether you face that really badly or really well, isn't really going to have any long-term impact on anyone else, because you're dead anyway, and so is everybody else, you know. So I can't see the point of that. What's interesting is that I was looking at a website that said, what 10 things do you know about Star Trek, if it's the only thing that you know? And the Kobayashi Maru was on there. Its impact culturally extends far out of Star Trek fandom. There's something about it that seems to have resonated with people. And I think it's because maybe we do face Owen situations quite a lot. It might not be about death or not, but it might be never getting a job and never being able to succeed or something. I don't know. And then it's like, well, how do you then measure up and carry on after that moment? So that's what I've always thought the value of the Kobayashi Maru is. It's a test of that sort of level of character, is how do you get yourself, pull yourself up and start again after you've been knocked down for the dozenth time. But you're right, in as much as you know in the test that it's not for real, so maybe that learning point isn't there either. But I think recovering from failure is a useful skill, and maybe that's what they're testing as well.
I think there's two responses here. So with regard to the cockiness, my question would be, if you give a cocky person a scenario that they cannot win, do they become less cocky, or do they just get annoyed at you being unfair? Like, do we expect the cocky person to take the right lesson here? And in particular, in Star Trek 2, we know Kirk didn't. We know Kirk tried it twice, got annoyed, and then reprogrammed it, and then he was given a commendation for original thinking. So they kind of rewarded it for his sheer refusal to accept that he wasn't unbeatable. Like that's one of the, I mean, I have my issues with the Abrams Trek, but that's one of the things I love about the first Abrams Trek film. In the alternative universe, they're just like, yeah, mate, you completely screwed this up. And then the other thing with regards to
I was going to say, and of course, one of the things about Kirk is he's got commendations all over the place, but he's also considered to be a menace by people that come after him. It's like he's kind of this ambivalent figure as far as the history books are concerned of the Federation of Planets, because yeah, he was cocky, but yeah, he broke the Prime Directive and the Temporal Prime Directive and God knows what, because he didn't learn that particular thing. So you're right, it doesn't make sense from any position, does it?
And then the other thing I would say is with regard to picking yourself up and trying again, I think there is a lot to that. So the interesting thing for me about the Kobayashi Maru is if you made somebody do it again, would they just refuse to answer the distress signal? Because essentially, I think what it's actually really trying to do, and maybe Kirk just didn't bother learning this because, as established, he doesn't, all he sees of this test is, oh, well, I got through it. That's the end of the story. What I think it's teaching you is you haven't made a mistake by saying we're going to go into the neutral zone to try and save some lives. The only way you can actually fail the Kobayashi Maru really is by saying, oh, we'll just let the people on the Kobayashi Maru die.
See, that's really interesting to me. I mean, so I feel like we've really comprehensively answered the question of why it's a no-win at the moment for Starfleet assessment. There's a lot of reasons. I guess this naturally follows, though, what would a win, what could turn it into a win for Starfleet assessment? I mean, based on what you're saying, Rick, I'm kind of feeling like, well, there's sort of two things that have jumped out at me so far. One is that if you actually ask somebody to do it twice, that would be an interesting thing to sort of see, you know, can they pick themselves back up? Can they learn from this resilience test of character, all of that? I suppose the other one as well is, do you just bin it and do what they did with Nog? So what would a win for Starfleet assessment look like, either with the Kobayashi Maru or without it?
So I think the problem with the Kobayashi Maru is it claims that the result is what matters, right? You focus on the result being you're dead either way, when in actual fact, it's the process, it's the decision to say, this might get us all killed, but we have a duty to save lives. And the question is whether or not there's another way that you can impart that lesson, that you can't be, if you're too cautious, you're no use as a starship captain, not only because being overly cautious can also get you killed, but because you have this humanitarian responsibility, which is key to what Starfleet is supposed to be.
I mean, that feels like an interesting thing to do even in the test or even as part of your feedback or something. That feels like you should be able to pass the Kobayashi Maru if you demonstrate those attributes. Like, that feels like the victory condition to me, or the assessment outstanding condition.
Yeah, and I think that's what Kirk should have said to, so it's Lieutenant Savick who's doing this, who is also a Vulcan. So Spock is half Vulcan, half human. Savick is fully Vulcan, and she objects to the test on the grounds that there's no way to win. Now, if I was running the Kobayashi Maru, if I was sort of forced to do this, Kirk's response is, well, you may have to consider the possibility of a no-win situation, and how we face death is just as important as how we face life. The message I would impart is, you're not winning the scenario by getting out alive. You can lose the scenario by refusing to try and help people because you're too worried in saving your own skin.
I love it. Mark and Mark, do you have any advances on how it could be made a win for Starfleet assessment?
I think for me, and I think you've already mentioned feedback, I mean any kind of assessment, the learning is the feedback, isn't it? And kind of then being placed back into a scenario and engaging with that feedback, feeding forward, and thinking about how you might do things differently. And I think that's probably wrong with this particular assessment, because I don't think there is very much feedback, and there is nothing, you know, to really engage with and to move forward with. So I would say, yes, I think probably what Rick is saying probably makes sense to me, because then it leads into kind of further discussions around that and choices, and really kind of valid discussions. It's all about feedback for me, and I think the feedback, which is just, you know, you can't win this, is not kind of valid enough for me. There's no learning taking place. So yeah, I think I'd agree with Rick on that point.
Mark one.
There is a version of the Kobayashi Maru, it's not canon because it's one of the novels, but in which Nog faces the Kobayashi Maru when he's on Earth doing his Starfleet Academy stuff, and he wins it by bribing the Cardassian people, because it's Cardassians, not Klingons at that point, because Klingons are allies by the 24th century. He bribes them. He just pays them loads of money to let the Kobayashi Maru go, and he wins it that way. So there's always ways around things. I don't know if that's something we'd want people to go away with, but also that does work, because that ties in with Rick's original thing about diversity. It's like, yeah, it's inclusivity. It's if we have a multicultural approach. The Ferengi have never been part of the United Federation of Planets. You know, Nog has to have a special invitation from Sisko to join Starfleet, because Ferenginar isn't part of the United Federation of Planets at that point. So he's the only Ferengi to ever go into Starfleet. And that just showed that that's a really good example of, by being multicultural, by bringing in as many people as possible into our education institutions, we can see alternatives that weren't there before, and all these different pathways to success, and that is one of them. It's, yeah, let's go back to good old capitalism and bribe the people to let the Kobayashi Maru go. So that's my only take. I'm not sure what I pulled generically from that, but there we go. That's one way around it.
So to summarize then, it feels like there's a couple of ways that the Kobayashi Maru could be made a win for Starfleet assessment. One would be to be a bit clearer about what you're actually trying to achieve with it as a piece of assessment, what you're trying to assess. Is it the strength of a person's character to stick to their humanity duties and do the right thing? Be transparent with your students on that, and make sure that you actually cover that in the feedback to them. Of course, you could be operating in a meritocratic way where you need to rank your people in a post-capitalist society. I suppose that means that all the people who don't have the human decency and empathy to go and rescue the Kobayashi Maru go to work for the Ferengi as bankers or something. The other thing there is, of course, to make it so that actually people can pass the Kobayashi Maru, so that you do permit multiple avenues, multiple inclusive paths for people of different abilities and species to work their way through it. Klingon, for example, doing the Kobayashi Maru might work out that it can actually be passed by beaming onto the opposing ships and start tearing people's heads off with their teeth. A Romulan might, unleash some sort of dreadful plague on them. The Ferengi could, of course, buy their way out of it, and the humans could do something generic and vanillary, which would involve a lot of talking, which seems to be most episodes of The Next Generation, from my memory. Not the strongest series. I know The Next Generation's got a lot of love for it, but it's no Voyager. Yeah, mate?
And I'd say, with any assessment that gets like remotely close to this, which I can't think of many assessment scenarios, but anything that gets remotely close to this, I think you've like mentioned empathy, but I would say like take smugness out of it. I think the worst thing that you could ever have done is have those double doors open and Captain Kirk walks in with a big on his face. And I think you just got to remove the smugness, because that's what I found really annoying.
So is that the actual learning outcome of the Kobayashi Maru? Remove smugness. Take the smugness out of Starfleet. What an excellent mod. Okay, I feel like we've comprehensively answered our question. Does anybody have any further advances on this before I move on to the next part of the show?
No.
Just that I keep coming back to trying to get away with asking my students to do an impossible maths question and making them sit and look at it for 3 hours and then go, it was secretly impossible and you have now learned that some maths problems can't be solved.
Do you do that?
No, I don't. It's having to be stoned to death.
Oh my god, I kind of, if you do anytime, like if one day you just sort of decide, I've had enough of this,
my career is over, let's
go out on a hike. Yeah, if you could live stream it, that would be incredible. I will sign up for that. I'll get snacks in. I can't wait. And you could call it the Kobayashi Maru. It would be amazing.
Do you remember Beedle's Abouts?
Yeah.
Because the whole scenario just reminds me of that. Do you remember all of the actors just like putting somebody really through it just for fun?
Yeah.
And it kind of really reminds me of that where the own everybody's in on it apart from the one person. So that one person is just so outnumbered by everyone who knows what they don't know.
Yeah. And famous at the end of every episode, the person who'd been put up went, I think I've really learned valuable lessons about life from Jeremy Beadle and I'd like to thank it.
Yeah. I have no hold of that one's head of the mic. I hate how that stuff just keeps on coming around. I remember, was it Trigger Happy TV? Similar. I personally loathe that. And Dead Ringers and Radio 4 used to do record balls. So I feel like we have comprehensively answered our question. Let's wrap up the show with the final part of the show where we share some of our tips for your own practice.
Part 3. Practical tips.
Okay, part 3, tips for your own practice around your own Kobayashi Marus for assessment. And who would like to come in first with their top tip based on what we've discussed so far?
Oh, yeah, I think the basic thing is decide what exactly it is you are trying to get out of that assessment and make sure that you are assessing that. And there are other things that are coming into obfuscate that, or have other variables that are coming in. So if you are, how do you react under stress, and can you react when things go wrong, then make sure that's how the thing's designed, so that that's what they're learning from it, and build that into the feedbacks.
So I guess my thing here is students have a rational expectation that you are going to play fair with them. There are potentially circumstances in which you're going to set up an assessment where you are in fact not fully being honest for the sake of making a point later on. Be very careful about deciding that is what you need to do, and make sure that in the what follows, the students have an opportunity to express what they felt about that. You have an opportunity to explain what the overall intention was, and it becomes a conversation about whether or not you were successful. Don't just pull the rug out from under them and say, this is to teach you that you won't always have a rug, and then swan out of the room for a pint of Robin and ale.
You won't always have a rug. There's a good principle to take away. But no, I totally agree. It's like, if that is an essential part of your authentic assessment, then you have to utilize it. You have to actually build on it and as Mark alluded to right at the beginning of the episode, you have to make students have to make sure that students are able to draw that lesson out of it. Mark, do you have anything that you want to add? Mr. Williams.
I think it's kind of really plotting out what your journey is, isn't it? And I think it's making sure that you have a successful journey. So, I mean, that's going to incorporate finding out who your students are, what their authentic needs are, you know, what their goals and ambitions are, whether something is safe for those students. But I think it's mapping that whole journey and being quite transparent about that journey and what's being achieved through it. So, I think that would be my tip, really. Look at it as a whole.
And I think I have two tips. My first tip is that you're probably needing to expect a knock on your door from the office for students, because if you have a 0% pass rate on one of your assessments, you may have some questions to answer. The other one is, I think this is another great case for getting your learning outcomes right from the start and the issues that you have if your learning outcomes are vague, fuzzy, unclear, and how it can propagate downwards into sort of the subsequent teaching. Because you do have to worry, as we sort of discussed at length earlier, what were the outcomes and objectives for this assessment? I think we've talked about, is it smugness removal? Is it teaching them that sometimes you're going to die and that's okay? What is the learning outcome to this assessment? I think nailing your learning outcomes early helps you do better Starfleet exams, like what Nog had.
That would be my comment, is that obviously they've fed back over the years and they've refined what it is. And yes, performing under stress is important if you're going to have a career in the military, but let's find a way to put people under those positions which are actually authentic and not knowing it's a test, and also and still being able to react under that sort of level of stress is a useful thing for them to be able to do, but not actually really being under stress because ultimately you know it's not for real. Really, the Kobayashi Maru doesn't test the thing it's supposed to be testing, which is how do you perform when you're facing death, because you know that you're in an exam and so therefore you're still not going to be demonstrating that particular skill.
Oh, and I suppose there's one more thing I'll throw in here as well, actually, which is understand your students. If you're teaching a stress-based scenario and you're a Vulcan, then how are you going to get, like, what's the value in that at all?
No, Mike, and I think there's a real difference between teaching someone the Green Cross Code and then just pushing them in front of a car.
Such a better analogy. Mark, where was that 20 minutes ago?
I got one last thing, which is just occurred to me. So in Star Trek VI, McCoy and Kirk end up in an alien prison, and McCoy talks about how he's really worried about he's going to go to sleep and then somebody's going to shank him, and that'll be the end of him, just a sudden prison killing with no warning. And what he actually says is, one night, Kobayashi Maru. So if your Star Trek assessment has become a byword for unjust death in a prison, you probably messed up. If one of my students on their deathbed says, oh, this is horrible, it's just like one of Rick's oral exams, I feel pretty bad.
But what a way to get immortality. If your exams become a byword for misery and death, then that's, you know.
Yeah, you've achieved something.
That's something. That's more than most of us will have.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So we have answered our question. We've shared our tips. What more could you possibly want, you greedy, greedy people? Thank you so very, very much for listening. You can subscribe to us on all of your favourite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, pedagogzilla.com. You can follow us and get in touch via, well, actually, you can't follow us anymore. Oh, sorry, this section's just been reworked because we're off Twitter. Oh, are you still on Twitter?
We're recording this mid-November, and this week I've switched from Twitter to Blue Sky, so I'm at Mark Childs on Blue Sky.
And Rick, where can people find you online? Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Oh, I would have thought so. So I write the Infinite Diversity Finite Combinations blog about Star Trek. That's idfc.co.uk. You can find a whole bunch of Trek essays there, including one on Coming of Age, which is a Next Generation episode in which Wesley attempts the Starfleet entrance exams.